From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Dr. Stephen C. Meyer, director of the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute in Seattle, and author of Return of the God Hypothesis, three scientific discoveries that reveal the mind behind the universe. Now let's join Hank Hanegraaff and Dr. Stephen Meyer in their conversation.
The multiverse is an attempt to explain the improbability associated with getting all the dials set to the right settings, if you will, by positing the existence of many, many other universes. But the problem with the multiverse hypothesis is, well, twofold. In the book, I explain that to explain the two different types of fine-tuning that we find in the universe, the fine-tuning of the initial arrangement of matter and energy, and the fine-tuning of the fundamental parameters of physics, the strength of the basic forces and the masses of elementary particles and the like. There are actually two different types of universe-generating mechanisms required. You have to have an inflationary cosmology to explain the fine-tuning of the initial conditions of the universe, and you need a universe-generating mechanism based on string theory to explain the different combinations of laws and constants of physics. But when you look at those two different universe-generating mechanism ideas, they require multiple what are called pure theoretical postulates or entities, things that we can't possibly verify. We simply posit them because of their ability to explain. Nothing wrong with that, but what occurs in the multiverse hypothesis is the proliferation of such theoretical entities. In string theory, you have to believe that strings are the fundamental units of reality. You have to believe that there are little bits of energy that wrap around the strings to constrain them in just the right way. In inflationary cosmology, you have to believe in something called an inflaton field. You have to believe that there are finely tuned inflaton shutoff energies. In my book, I list 10 separate pure theoretical postulates that are held by these two different theories that give rise to universe generating mechanisms. 10 abstract theoretical postulates that you have to affirm, as opposed to the one single postulate of a transcendent intelligence. And so by Occam's razor, the theistic design hypothesis is much simpler and much more parsimonious than the multiverse hypothesis, where you have to, in addition to all the theoretical postulates associated with the universe generating mechanisms, you also have to believe in all those billions and billions of other universes. Then secondly, the second big problem is that even in the multiverse hypothesis, you still have prior unexplained fine-tuning. Because it turns out that in theory, those universe-generating mechanisms that are necessary for the multiverse proponent to portray our universe as something like the lucky winner of a great cosmic lottery, those underlying universe-generating mechanisms, even in theory, must be exquisitely finely tuned to allow them to produce new universes. And so the multiverse hypothesis presupposes prior unexplained fine-tuning, the very thing it was designed to explain in the first place. So we're right back to where we started. And yet, in our experience, what we mean by fine-tuning is an ensemble of improbable parameters that work jointly to accomplish some discernible end or exemplify some set of functional requirements. So finely tuned systems in our experience would include things like finely tuned French recipes, finely tuned internal combustion engines, finely tuned combinations of electrical parts to create a radio receiver, for example. In our experience, fine tuning is always the product of intelligent design. And if it is the case, and it is the case that the multiverse hypothesis does not ultimately explain the origin of fine tuning, but merely pushes the question back one generation, then the best explanation, and in fact, the only known cause of fine-tuning remains intelligent design. And therefore, even if the multiverse hypothesis is true, it doesn't circumvent the implication of fine-tuning, namely that there must have been a prior designing agent responsible for it.
I find it really interesting that someone of the intellectual capacity of a Stephen Hawking, someone who you seem to have a soft spot in your heart for, at least that's what I perceive when I hear you speak of him, and in your books you mention him, but he held to this multiverse hypothesis, and yet a colleague, Roger Penrose, pointed out that this hypothesis, just as you said, is impotent and misconceived.
Well, one of the things you find with the great scientists is that, and associated with all these discoveries, is the sympathy for an alternative that is non-design, non-theistic hypothesis is not really driven by the scientific evidence itself. These are questions in the end of science, but also of philosophy. And Hawking was a great scientist, but I think he was a rather weak philosopher. And I do have a tremendous soft spot for him. I think his personal story was tremendously inspiring. I was fortunate to attend a lecture series while I was a PhD student in Cambridge that was the basis of his book, A Brief History of Time. But Hawking was a kind of God-obsessed atheist. He was fascinated with the big questions. I think the most important work he did was in proving the singularity theorems. In fact, he first formulated the idea of the cosmological singularity in his 1966 PhD dissertation. And in his examination, he was encouraged by Roger Penrose, one of the examiners, to develop the mathematical case for the singularity theorem in more detail, which he did collaboratively with Penrose and then with George Ellis. So he made one of the great discoveries, I think, of all time in physics, which is that he used theoretical physics to reinforce the conclusion that the universe must have a beginning. But then he bristled and bridled at that the rest of his scientific career and formulated the first major theory of quantum cosmology. And in the book, of course, as I explained before in the interview, I argue that quantum cosmology, if true, has its own latent or tacit theistic implications. So I don't think Hawking really ever got around it. But he also had a fundamental confusion in his thinking that was philosophical in character. He liked to say that the laws of physics made clear why there was a universe, you know, how the universe came into existence. There is such a thing as the law of gravity, he said, helps to explain how the universe came into existence. And we don't need to invoke God to light the blue touch paper that sparks everything and gets things going. But there's a fundamental confusion. The laws of physics do not explain where things came from. They don't even explain why specific events happen. The laws of physics describe how matter and energy interact with each other in a mathematical way, in a regular way. They describe those interactions once you have matter and energy. They don't tell you where the matter and energy or the space and time came from in the first place. They're not explanations for causal origins. They're descriptions of natural regularities. And Krauss is subject to the same philosophical error. They treat the laws of nature as if they were causes of things rather than descriptions of regularities. And the one thing we know they certainly didn't cause is the origin of the universe itself, because prior to the origin of matter, space, time, and energy, there is nothing for the laws of nature to describe.
Talk about panspermia, directed or undirected. It's become popularized in our culture. I see all these segments, for example, on Tucker Carlson, where he's talking about unidentified aerial phenomena or UFOs. Discuss how this got so popular and possible problems with what has been popularized on television in this regard.
Well, right. I mean, this is going to be very popular, and I'm not sure when you're airing this interview, but on June 25th, there will be a report from the Navy on some of these visual phenomena that have raised suspicions about the possible existence of visitations in our airspace from intelligent aliens. I'm very skeptical about the interpretations of those phenomena that suggest that aliens have visited our planet, but I doubt that the Navy's report is going to settle the question one way or another. There are many alternative interpretations of those phenomena, and so I'm sure that debate will go on. But the reason that scientists have proposed the existence or activity of aliens has nothing to do with these visual phenomena that the pilots have reported, but rather the difficulty associated with the problem of the origin of the first life on Earth. Francis Crick famously was quoted in the book called Life Itself as saying that an honest man armed with all the data that we have could only say that in some sense, the origin of life is almost a miracle. So many were the conditions that would have had to have been set to get life going. So pretty close but rough paraphrase there of his quotation. And he posited the idea of intelligent life being seeded here on Earth because he recognized that the conditions on the early Earth were not conducive to a spontaneous chemical origin of life, still less the origin of the information that would be needed to produce life. So he posited that life had first arisen on some other planet and then had evolved into a highly intelligent form of life and some civilization, and that those intelligent aliens seeded life on Earth. He then kind of backed off from that because he got a lot of pushback from his colleagues and said that he would never formulate any ideas about the origin of life ever again.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Dr. Stephen Meyer. Many intellectuals insist that science and belief in God are at war. In Return of the God Hypothesis, Stephen Meyer argues that theism, with its affirmation of a transcendent, intelligent, and active creator, best explains the evidence we have concerning our origins. Meyer provides an evidence-based answer to perhaps the ultimate mystery of the universe. The result? A stunning conclusion. The data support not only the existence of an intelligent designer of some kind, but the existence of a personal God. To receive your copy of Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit us at equip.org. That's equip.org.
Many intellectuals insist that science and belief in God are at war. In Return of the God Hypothesis, Stephen Meyer argues that theism, with its affirmation of a transcendent, intelligent, and active creator, best explains the evidence we have concerning biological and cosmological origins. Previously, Meyer refrained from attempting to answer questions about who might have designed life. Now he provides an evidence-based answer to the ultimate mystery of the universe. The results? Meyer reveals a stunning conclusion. The data support not just the existence of an intelligent designer of some kind, but the existence of a personal God. To receive your copy of Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org. That's equip.org.
Breaking the code of the Book of Revelation has become an international obsession. The result has been rampant misreading of Scripture, bad theology, and even bad politics and foreign policy. In the Apocalypse Code, find out what the Bible really says about the end times and why it matters today. Hank Hanegraaff argues that the key to understanding the last book of the Bible is the other 65 books of the Bible, not current events or recent history. The Apocalypse Code offers sane answers to some very controversial questions, such as, what does it mean to take the book of Revelation literally? Who are the Antichrist and the Great Whore of Babylon? And what is the real meaning of 666? Order The Apocalypse Code by Hank Hanegraaff today. Available in softcover, MP3 CD, or MP3 download from equip.org. Or call 888-7000-CRI. Anyone who's been paying attention knows there's a war going on, not just on traditional morality, civility, and decency, but even more fundamentally on historic notions of truth. And the enemy isn't just the onslaught of fake news facilitated by a post-truth culture and turbocharged by growing legions of ideological spin doctors. No, the real enemies of truth range from postmodernist convictions that there is no objective truth to militant scientism that claims that only science can determine truth, and religion is little more than primitive superstitions. But CRI support team members are not waving a white flag of surrender. They're holding the fort by undergirding every one of Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping and life-changing outreaches 24/7. To learn how you can make a difference and enjoy all the benefits of support team membership, simply visit equip.org.
pennsperm.org.
Let's rejoin Bible Answer Man host Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Dr. Stephen Meyer, in their conversation.
Richard Dawkins, in a 2008 film, Expelled, similarly speculated about life being seated here on Earth after being asked by Ben Stein in the film about the problem of the origin of life. And Dawkins, interestingly, said, well, there might well be a signature of intelligence inside cells, which got my attention because I was at the time writing a book called Signature in the Cell. But he said it would have had to have arisen by an evolutionary process somewhere else in the cosmos, and then those intelligent agents that evolved from the life that arose somewhere else would have seeded life to our planet. I think that scientists have resorted to such speculative hypotheses tells you something about the difficulty of the problem of the origin of life, but also that they've invoked intelligence of some kind also tells you that what they're seeing inside living cells justifies an inference to intelligent design. Dawkins just recently tweeted that he was knocked sideways by the evidence of the complex and intricate data processing system that is at work inside cells. And he provided a link to an animation of DNA replication that had been produced by an Australian medical group. That didn't lead him to question his atheism, but on other occasions, these signatures of intelligence inside cells have led him to speculate about alien intelligence as being the source of the integrated complexity and design we're seeing in the living cell. I think the panspermia hypothesis has an obvious defect or two. First, it only pushes the question of the ultimate origin of life and the ultimate origin of information off onto some other planet without explaining how information could have arisen from simpler non-living chemicals. And that has been the main source of the impasse that afflicts modern chemical evolutionary theory in the field of origin of life studies among scientists studying the origin of life on Earth. So the main question has just been begged. They've just pushed the problem out into space without solving it. But secondly, no being within the cosmos, intelligent or otherwise, alien or otherwise, could account for the origin of the universe itself or the origin of the fine-tuning of the universe for life that makes the existence of any form of life, terrestrial or otherwise, possible. So positing an extraterrestrial intelligence within the cosmos doesn't tell you where the cosmos came from or how it got finely tuned so that a terrestrial intelligence or extraterrestrial intelligence could have evolved over time. So the panspermia space alien designer hypothesis might explain the origin of life on some other planet. I think if it does so, it does so very weakly, but it certainly doesn't explain the fine-tuning of the universe or its ultimate origin. And thus, that's another reason that I favor a theistic design hypothesis as the best explanation for that ensemble of evidence for those big three discoveries that have been made about the origin of the universe, its fine-tuning, and the origin of life and the information necessary to produce it.
I want to get to a couple of other subjects quickly, subjects that you talk about in your book. One of them being how critics of intelligent design consistently are misrepresenting intelligent design as a God of the gaps argument, an argument from ignorance.
Yeah, this is consistent and probably one of the most popular objections to the case for intelligent design. An argument from ignorance has the following form. In an argument from ignorance or a gaps argument, you say, well, cause A is not capable of producing effect X. Therefore, cause B must have done it. But in saying that, you offer no evidence that cause B is capable of producing effect X. You're arguing purely on your ignorance about what cause B can or cannot do. That's not the kind of argument we're making in support of intelligent design. We're saying that natural processes, known natural processes of various kinds, those that are based on chance, those that are based on natural laws, those that are based on the combination of the two, have not demonstrated the capability of producing, for example, functional digital information. Yet we do know of another cause, let's call that cause B, namely intelligent agency, which is known to produce functional digital information. We have independent experience or reason to think that minds can produce the kind of information that we find in living cells and that we find in other systems, such as computer codes. So we're not arguing from our ignorance of what the alternative cause can do, but rather we're arguing based on our knowledge of what the cause can do. And therefore, the argument is not an argument from ignorance, but rather it has a different logical structure, which is known as an inference to the best explanation. Now, I extend that defense of intelligent design to the God hypothesis itself by bringing in other considerations about how you can establish what's known as causal adequacy for a theoretical entity, and showing that what we do in making the case, or what I do in making the case for the God hypothesis as a better explanation than, for example, naturalism, pantheism, deism, or space alien designer hypotheses, is to show that we have good reason to think that the concept of God has associated with it certain attributes that give God what we call the causal power to produce the effects in question, that there are positive reasons to think that if God exists, then God would provide a better explanation of the facts, because associated with the concept of God are certain causal powers, which are precisely the ones you would need to account for the things that we see in the universe around us. It's a little bit of a variation on the Dawkins riff, where he says the properties of the universe are exactly what we would expect if at bottom there was no purpose, no design, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. I argue that the great discoveries that have been made about biological and cosmological origins and about the nature of life itself, the nature of the universe, are precisely what we would expect if God existed and had acted to bring the universe and life into existence. And that argument takes a little bit more space to unpack, but I do that in chapter 20, the penultimate chapter of the book, where I'm responding to some of these philosophical objections to the case, both for intelligent design and for a larger theistic design hypothesis of the kind I defend in the new book.
Perhaps one final question. We hear, in particular during the pandemic, we've heard follow the science, or follow the science wherever it leads. And it seems to me that oftentimes the idea of science is confabulated with the idea of pseudoscience. Could you weigh in on that?
Well, pseudoscience is usually a term of abuse that is reserved for scientists who hold a different view than the one that you favor. And there's an awful lot of, in many, many discussions now, appeals to quote unquote settled science or consensus science. And it's almost a rule with me now that when you hear scientists refer to settled science or to consensus, that they're usually doing so in order to silence scientific dissent, in order to settle a debate that isn't settled. No one invokes settled science or consensus science to justify the claim that the formula for water is H2O, or the formula for salt is NaCl, or that Newton's inverse square law has a particular form. You only invoke settled science when you're trying to shut somebody up who has a different interpretation of the scientific evidence than you do, and to suppress dissenting opinion. And so underlying that common appeal that's being made to settled science in our culture today, whether it's about climate change or Darwinian evolution or any one of the many scientific issues that were in play during the pandemic, the use of settled science as a kind of rhetorical club or cudgel betrays a false understanding of the way science works. Science doesn't work as scientists speak univocally and provide a set of unquestioned deliverances to the rest of us. Rather, science advances as scientists argue about how to interpret the evidence. At some point in most subjects, we get to a point where there's not a lot of debate any longer and there is a consensus. But when that happens, you don't need to appeal to consensus. And if you use an appeal to consensus to subvert the process of theory evaluation, comparative theory evaluation, and argumentation that's necessary to the advance of science, you're actually doing something profoundly unscientific. There's a wonderful Italian philosopher of science, Marcello Pera. Pera says that science advances as scientists argue about how to interpret evidence. There's a rhetorical dimension to science. And if we subvert that, if we suppress that by premature appeals to science or by allowing groupthink to have its head, we will undermine the very scientific enterprise and prevent scientists from getting to the truth, getting to the best explanation or the best interpretation of the evidence, which is what we want. So we have to be very careful about those appeals to consensus. They can be applied in a way that actually undermines the very process of science itself.
Well, this has been just an incredible discussion. Dr. Stephen Meyer, thank you so much for the quality of time you have devoted to the Hank Unplugged podcast.
Thank you for being so well and deeply prepared for this discussion. It's been just really a joy to talk to you.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and I hope everyone listening in gets the book, Return of the God Hypothesis. It is available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with me in the battle for life and truth. My thanks to Dr. Stephen Meyer, and for all of you to tuning in to this edition of Hank Unplugged.
Thank you for joining us for this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Dr. Stephen Meyer, author of Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. To hear this Hank Unplugged podcast interview in its entirety, go to equip.org, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI. Or visit our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more.
Many intellectuals insist that science and belief in God are at war. In Return of the God Hypothesis, Stephen Meyer argues that theism, with its affirmation of a transcendent, intelligent, and active creator, best explains the evidence we have concerning biological and cosmological origins. Previously, Meyer refrained from attempting to answer questions about who might have designed life. Now he provides an evidence-based answer to the ultimate mystery of the universe. The results? Meyer reveals a stunning conclusion. The data support not just the existence of an intelligent designer of some kind, but the existence of a personal God. To receive your copy of Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org. That's equip.org.